A few years ago, I got to see the Colorado mountain ranges for the very first time. And it was an amazing experience driving through the reality of what I had only seen in photographs. Photographs may capture the beauty of the mountains in amazing detail, but nothing beats the real thing. Nothing beats actually being there and seeing the reality of what the pictures point to. And in Hebrews 7 through 8, we see that Jesus is the real thing to the photograph of the Old Covenant. And in particular, the high priesthood of Jesus brings to perfection what was lacking in the Old Covenant priesthood. It's the real thing. It's the reality rather than the shadow. And this change in priesthood has massive implications for us today who live in the newer and better covenant through Jesus Christ. This is Understanding Hebrews. We've seen through these last few chapters how Jesus serves as the substance to the shadow of Old Covenant realities. Remember, shadows exist only to point us to a person. If you see a shadow coming around the corner of a building, you know that there's a person behind it. And if the person walks up to you and you continue to talk to the shadow, that's offensive to the person and it makes no sense. And so for Christians who are of Jewish descent, who were tempted to turn back to Judaism in the days in which Hebrews was written, they're tempted to go back and say, I can have all of God without Jesus. And Hebrews is saying, well, you really can't. Because everything in the Old Covenant is pointing forward towards Jesus. The rest of Israel in the Promised Land is just pointing forward to the greater Sabbath rest of all creation. The faithfulness of Moses points forward to the ultimate faithfulness of Christ, who is the Son. And so don't turn back. If you choose the shadow over the person, you're choosing the lesser over the greater. You're going backwards in time in redemptive history, and that's not a good thing. And so here in Hebrews 7 to 8, we see the heart of the book's argument that the Levitical priesthood of the Old Covenant must give way to Christ's priesthood of the New Covenant. That's a shocking claim. The Levitical priesthood is the heart of the Old Covenant system. So the priests handle all of the religious rites and sacrifices for sins. So how can Jesus, who doesn't even belong to the priestly tribe of Levi, replace such a long-standing and critical institution? This is a huge deal. This changes everything. It's so cataclysmic in its nature that Hebrews devotes so much time to arguing for the legitimacy of Christ's priesthood. And not just the legitimacy, but the supremacy of Christ's priesthood. And the author of Hebrews uses Old Testament references to point to this reality, that Jesus belongs to a greater priesthood that both precedes and also exceeds the Levitical priesthood. Let's look at the first 10 verses of chapter 7 as we build this argument and try to follow the thought patterns of the author of Hebrews. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He is first, by translation of his name, King of Righteousness, and then he is also King of Salem, that is, King of Peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. See how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. And those descendants of Levi who received the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, though these also are descended from Abraham. But this man, who does not have his descent from them, received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. In the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it is testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. This section begins with a focus on four details of Abraham's encounter with the mysterious figure of Melchizedek, who we first meet in Genesis chapter 14. First, he's both a priest of the Most High God and the king of Salem, which sets him apart as a priest king. Second, he both blessed and received tithes from Abraham, which indicates his superiority over Abraham. And the Levites, who descended from Abraham, in a sense, paid tithes to Melchizedek through their ancestor, meaning that the Levites, through Abraham, also recognize the superiority of Melchizedek's priesthood over theirs. Third, his name, Melchizedek, translates to King of Righteousness, and the city that he rules, Salem, means peace, shalom. And many people think that Salem is actually the precursor to Jerusalem, that he's actually a former king of Jerusalem. He's unique in both his character and his stature. So that's the third thing. Finally, he's not given a genealogy, which gives him a resemblance to the Son of God. Melchizedek metaphorically comes from no one, and he passes on his priesthood to no one, for he remains a priest forever. Now, he likely had a genealogy, but the fact that it's not listed is a detail that Moses picks up on in Genesis 14 as peculiar. He is unique in his priesthood. It's not based on bloodline or descent, but a quality of life, a kind of life. And in this way, he resembles Jesus, who doesn't have a beginning or an end. He is divine. He lives forever. And so this lack of genealogy, quote unquote, is the resemblance between Melchizedek and Jesus. What Melchizedek has metaphorically, Jesus has in reality. Jesus lives as a priest forever. There is no person he passes on his priesthood to. There is no beginning of his priesthood in the sense of he is the eternal Son. And so all of these elements come together to show that Melchizedek is greater than Levi, and Jesus is of the order of Melchizedek. Or rather, Melchizedek is of the order of Jesus, because Jesus existed before Melchizedek. And so the permanence of Jesus' priesthood reveals the impermanence of the Levitical priesthood. Jesus, the ultimate king priest of righteousness and peace who lives forever, is the reality of which Melchizedek is only a pointer, a metaphor of sorts. Let's get to the inferiority of the Levitical priesthood. If Melchizedek's priesthood is superior and Jesus is superior as well, then that shows that there's a flaw intrinsic to the Old Covenant Levitical priesthood system. And we're going to uncover that in the next couple verses, 11 to 21 of chapter 7. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek rather than one named after the order of Aaron? For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well. For the one of whom these things are spoken belonged to another tribe, from which no one has ever served at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, and in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. For it is witnessed of him, "You are a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek." For on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced, through which we draw near to God. And it was not without an oath, for those who formerly became priests were made such without an oath. But this one was made a priest with an oath by the one who said to him, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, you are a priest forever." So Hebrews advances from defending the perfection of Christ's priesthood to exposing the imperfection, the flaw of the Old Covenant Levitical priesthood. And the fatal flaw of the Old Covenant is that it never perfected anyone. We learn later in Hebrews 10:4 that it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sin. So God never intended the Old Covenant system as the perfection, or a better word would be a fulfillment of his plan of redemption. It can't be the final stage because it doesn't deal decisively with sins. The Old Covenant is good and holy, but only temporary. It is weak and useless in its ability to resolve the issue of sin and death. Therefore, if the solution to sin and death does not come through the Old Covenant Levitical priesthood, then there must exist a better covenant with a better priesthood to deal with the actual problem. And this hope of a better priesthood and a better covenant comes not from the New Testament, but from the Old Testament. God swears with an oath in Psalm 110 that the Messiah will reign as both king and priest forever. And that's exactly what we get in Jesus. So what if he's not descended from Aaron and the Levites? That priesthood can't save us anyways. In fact, that priesthood becomes corrupt by the time Jesus shows up in the first century. We need a better priesthood. We need a better lineage. The former priests receive their appointment by genealogy, by bloodline. But Jesus receives his appointment by something greater, God's oath, He promises in his word that Jesus will be this great high priest who is like Melchizedek. We don't need a priest with the right bloodline. In fact, blood descent assumes generations, which assumes death. The succession of different generations means one passes away, another one assumes its place. But we need a priest with an indestructible life who conquers death. And if we receive a new priest, that means we also receive a new covenant or administration, or as Hebrews refers to it, as a law or commandment. And we're going to learn a little bit about that in the next couple verses, verses 7:22 to 8:6. This makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office, but he holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. Now, the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. God always deals with his people through covenants, and a covenant is a legal and binding relationship between God and his people, which features blessings and curses. Covenants also feature a mediator that acts on behalf of men in relation to God. So in the old covenant system, the high priest offers sacrifices for his own sins and those of his people as a mediator. And when he dies, another from his bloodline takes his place. Now, one high priest may serve faithfully, but his replacement unfaithfully. And this places the people of God in a precarious predicament because they don't know if this next guy is going to be faithful. And the history of Israel shows that the high priests really weren't that great. So even the best and most faithful high priest is going to succumb to death. But Jesus, as our great high priest, never sinned, which means he's the perfect mediator. Why were there so many old covenant priests? They all kept dying. Why do I only need one new covenant priest? Because Jesus lives forever. And that means that he always lives to mediate for us. He always lives to intercede for us. His mediation never ends. Our standing with God is as indestructible as Jesus' life. More than that, Jesus serves as the perfect sacrifice. He's holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. If you think about the old covenant sacrifices, they had to be unblemished. They had to be perfect and pure. Well, Jesus exemplifies that. And because he himself is not a sinner, because he actually is pure, and he actually is a man, his sacrifice is so potent that it only needs to be offered once. It's once for all. There's no need for any more sacrifices after Jesus Christ. He is the reality to which the old covenant sacrifices pointed towards. So why would you ever want to go back to the old covenant priesthood? Jesus is so much better. The old covenant is only a shadow, but Jesus is the substance. And if you don't believe me, Hebrews says, read the Old Testament. Moses designed the tent, the tabernacle, based upon a pattern shown to him on Mount Sinai. What's the pattern? It's the heavenly tabernacle. In other words, there is a blueprint of a heavenly reality that the earthly tabernacle is meant to be a copy of. So we're looking at a photograph. We're looking at a photograph of something much higher, a greater reality, a heavenly reality, when we look at the old covenant priesthood. So the old covenant system you want to return to is just a photograph of the mountain range. But in Jesus, you get to go to the actual mountain. That's the point. We need a heavenly priest with a heavenly sacrifice to deal with sins forever. And this means we now live under a new administration, a new order or covenant, not like the old covenant under Moses and the Levitical priests. And this promise of a new covenant also finds its roots in the Old Testament. Hebrews quotes from Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34 to show that God always intended the old covenant to pass away in order that the new covenant may come. Listen to these last couple verses in chapter 8. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second, for he finds fault with them when he says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more." In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete, and what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. Hebrews again highlights the fundamental flaw of the Old Covenant. It can't deal decisively with sin, and so, because it's full of sinners, it always gets broken. The Old Covenant features a mixed community of both believers, like David, Moses, and Elijah, and non-believers, like Ahab, Jezebel, and all those terrible kings you read about in 1 and 2 Kings. For the entirety of Israel's history, the non-believers outnumber the believers, but they're all part of the Old Covenant. But the promise of the New Covenant is this: they're all going to be believers. That's what's different, that the composition is not a mixed community, but it is a regenerate community, a community of believers who have their hearts changed. Whereas the Old Covenant, only a small remnant knew the Lord, had the law written on their hearts, and received forgiveness of sins, in the New Covenant, they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. Now, we'll get to the question of how Old Covenant believers were saved in a later episode, but for now, don't miss the big point. Jesus' new priesthood brings a new covenant, and that new covenant brings greater blessing because it cannot be broken. It has greater security because it is secured by the blood of Christ, and all those who are part of the covenant have the Holy Spirit, who empowers us to keep the covenant, not be perfect, but to remain faithful, to continue on until the end. Hebrews is also written in a time when there's an overlap, when the Old Covenant and the New Covenant systems exist side by side. That's why he says what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. In other words, when Hebrews is being written, there's still a temple, there's still priests offering sacrifices. The Old Covenant system is still happening alongside the New Covenant system. There's this overlap period of time. And so there's a sense in which the Old Covenant has not yet passed away. The New Covenant has begun, and it's overlapping with the passing away of the Old Covenant. But in less than a decade, in about 70 AD, the Romans are going to come in, they're going to destroy the temple, which ends the sacrificial system and it ends the Levitical priesthood. And it's still ended to this day. If you go to Jerusalem, there's a mosque over where the temple was destroyed. You can't go back to the Old Covenant if you tried. And so 70 AD is a critical point in history, because God actually decisively within history, not just theologically, but historically, ends the Old Covenant. It has actually passed away, and all that remains is the New Covenant people of God, the New Covenant temple in which we gather, indwelt by the Spirit as living stones, in which Jesus is our great high priest who always lives to intercede for us, in which the perfect sacrifice has been offered. And through him, we draw near to God. So don't turn back to the Old Covenant. The Old Covenant points to Jesus. It points to a new covenant, a better covenant. And it shows the goodness and the graciousness of God, that God himself comes into history to start a new covenant, to bring all of his lost children home. That's the promise. That's the guarantee. That's the hope that the gospel gives. And that hope is exemplified in the high priesthood of Christ, the great sacrifice, the great high priest, and the great guarantor of a better covenant.